didn't print enough. People can sleep. I will go ahead and start. First to introduce myself, my name is Stephen Volz. Here now in my second week of teaching at Holden. Last week I was teaching mostly about, religion and politics in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, looking at five individuals whose Christian faith inspired them to get involved in politics in some fashion. This week, I'm kind of moving beyond my comfort zone in some respects, because I'm a professor of African history at Kenyon College in Ohio, in the history department, so I teach some other history classes, but primarily I teach African history. And teaching African history is primarily sub-Saharan African history. And so when I thought, okay, what should I do for a second week, I thought, well, maybe moving beyond my comfort zone, but in an area where I'm probably as much a student as I am a teacher, and that is into North Africa. So what I've done, the sessions I've organized for this week are based on a seminar that I attended last summer. For about 6 weeks, it was run by the Fulbright program, U.S. government program, for about, I think it was about 15 of us, faculty from various American colleges. And we went to North Africa, specifically Morocco and Tunisia, for 6 weeks. And the topic of the whole six-week seminar was religious diversity in the Maghreb, or religious diversity in Western North Africa. And so for me, that was fascinating. For one, I wanted to learn more about North Africa, because when I teach African history, I prefer to see the continent as a whole, because I would argue that the connections between North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa are just as strong as the connections between North Africa and, say, the Middle East. I think there's a tendency to look at North Africa and think of it as part of the so-called Arab world or Muslim world and forget the fact that it's very much part of Africa as well. I think we kind of look at it as racialized African history as well and think, well, there was, it's a different history. But in fact, there's a long, rich history of crossing the Sahara Desert between the two. Anyways, so with that rationale, I was invited to participate in the seminar to learn more about North Africa. My main interest was in learning more about these trans-Saharan connections. But as a Christian and as somebody whose research is on African Christianity, I also find it fascinating just the topic of religious pluralism in the Maghreb. So what I found, and I hope you'll agree with me, it's kind of fascinating, is how much in the Maghreb the three Abrahamic religions, the three monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, how much their history is intertwined in that region of the world, in that region of Africa. How much they've influenced one another, and how much, in many respects, there's been sort of a harmonious coexistence in that region. And so what I envision doing today and in my next three sessions is sort of offering some of my impressions from the seminar, some based on the seminar itself, as well as from some extra reading I did, four topics. Today I took a look at Judaism, which I call People of the Book, looking at the history of Judaism in the Maghreb and how it's interacted with Islam and Christianity in that area. And tomorrow, actually, I'm thinking of shifting around the order to make a little more sense. Either tomorrow or the next day, I'll be then talking about Sufism, or the unity of God, and how mystical Islam has served as a vehicle for fostering connections between the three religions again, as well as bringing in sort of Berber or indigenous African religions, also are part of that mix. Then the third topic is on looking at Christianity, sort of a brief survey of the history of Christianity, but really focusing more on what were the interactions between Christianity and Islam within the Maghreb. And then concluding with discussing the film Of Gods and Men, which is going to be shown Wednesday night, about a group of French monks in the mountains, the Atlas Mountains of Algeria during the 1990s, and their experiences during an Islamist insurrection against the government there. So all of this has to do with the relationship between these three religions in that region. And so my whole point, again, as I'm trying to say, is that the Maghreb offers an interesting, in some ways, unique case of how these three religions have interacted. Because that's what I'm coming into this with, is this question. I think, you look at the media today, you see the news, you read the newspapers, and I think that over and over again, the constant emphasis is on how distinct and different and competitive different religions are, that they're somehow mutually exclusive and at one another's throats. I mean, just look at whether it's the Holocaust or whether it's 9/11. And there's just the assumption is that the norm for religions is that somehow they're inherently intolerant. that they are exclusivist, and that, you know, I mean, I think that sort of, you know, feeds kind of a secularist view of religion, that they're somehow, you know, just prone to violence. Well, I would argue that while there are obviously cases of, you know, religiously inspired violence, if you look at the long durée of history, and if you look at all around the world, I would argue the norm is the other, that more often religions coexist peacefully, even if they don't make the news. And this is, in my, from my perspective, this is what the Maghreb offers, is that over the course of centuries, you have all kinds of examples of coexistence and harmony and mutual learning and influence on these different religious traditions in the Maghreb. And other people have pointed out to me, you'll find similar things elsewhere, on sort of on the fringes of the Muslim world, as it were. That if you look at Turkey, if you look at Indonesia and so on, you have a similar phenomenon. And if you look at sub-Saharan Africa as well, you know, the Islamic parts of West Africa and East Africa, the same thing is happening. There's all kinds of synthesis between these religious traditions. So that's what I'm planning to illustrate by talking about the Maghreb. Before I get into that, though, I couldn't find a good place to post this where people might see it. But it's just part of my general introduction. Whenever I talk about Africa, I feel compelled to point out once again that Africa is not just one place. It is a vast continent. And here's a little map to give you some sense. Here's the continent of Africa to a scale of 1 to 10 million. And here's the state of Washington to the same scale. So you think how long it takes to drive from Spokane to Seattle on a nice paved road going 70 miles an hour? Well, you know, take that distance onto here and think of it as a rutted gravel road, you know, going over and up and down the stream and so forth, and you get a sense of how vast this continent is. And so when somebody says, oh, that must, you know, Africa is one place or one country, it's kind of absurd. I mean, it's a vast continent. It has about 1/4 of the world's countries, 1/3 of the world's languages. And if you look at the genetic diversity of the human race, there's as much genetic diversity among the people of Africa as there is among the rest of the world's people put together. So that somebody in Papua New Guinea and someone in Iceland have just as much in common genetically as someone in Mozambique has with someone in Mauritania. I think we tend to look at Africa through the lens of U.S. history and kind of racialize it, that they're all black or they're all have the same kind of basic culture. What's the African way to do things and so on. It's a tremendously diverse continent, and it's very difficult to generalize about any of it. So that's what we'll be talking about, you know, this week, is looking at what's called the Maghreb. Maghreb is just from the Arabic for the West, and it was the word that Arabic-speaking peoples used for the Western extent of what, for, you know, many years was the Western extent of the Islamic world, or the Muslim world. So looking at, you know, in modern terms, the countries of Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, or really dominated by the Atlas Mountains here in the Sahara Desert, and of course the Western Mediterranean. So that's my kind of lengthy introduction. Any questions so far? Comments, concerns, objections? All right. Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, some questions that come to my mind. Oops, pulled on the screen. Yeah, I mean, some questions that I guess I hope to address and have us discuss, because I know in this room there's other people who are professors of religious studies and have probably more expertise than I do, and so I'm looking forward to a discussion. But the questions I would pose, one is, you know, to what extent were Jews in the Maghreb integral fellow members of a predominantly Berber and Arab society, and to what extent were they distinct and seeing themselves as a separate ethnic group? Because one could argue, you know, if one was a Berber Jew or an Arab Jew, you know, what does that mean? When we're used to dividing those things together. How did they get along with the Muslim majority? You know, during the broad expanse of the history of the Maghreb. And how did the Maghreb, at the same time, relate to the centers of the Muslim world, to Saudi Arabia? And then another question comes to mind, especially when you look at U.S., we think of American society as being somewhat unique, as being this sort of melting pot or salad bowl, as it were. But I would argue that that's, again, more the norm. If you go to places like the Maghreb or most places in the world, you find societies are melting pots and mixing, you know, with different cultures mixing together, and that's the same thing here. And so, tons of questions there. Does the Maghreb have any lessons to offer for the United States on how to get along or not get along. Man, so people in the book. So yeah, those few of you who got a handout, this is on the cover there, and it's meant to illustrate sort of one of my main points. This was in a museum in Casablanca. It was a Jewish museum, but it could have been just as easily have been an Arab art museum or a Berber art museum or a whatever museum, because this amulet, I think, does a good job of showing this synthesis. This is, I think, from the 15th or 16th century. Well, you see, basically, there's three different religious traditions combined in this amulet. On the one hand, perhaps most obviously, of the Star of David there, and this was considered by those who used it. I mean, it was Jewish individuals who used this as an amulet, as a good luck charm, and the Star of David indicates that. But you also have this hand shape, a hand of Fatima. This is a symbol you find on doors throughout Morocco, a hand of Fatima, Fatima being one of the daughters of Muhammad, and it was seen as sort of the blessing of the daughter Muhammad was on your house if you had a hand of Fatima on there. And there's other amulets to find that don't have a Star of David and don't have parts as others, but it's clearly a hand of Fatima. So they basically have incorporated the Star of David with the hand of Fatima, and then just for good measure, cover all their bases. It's also, this is a bird here. It's meant to be you've all made your, hand turkeys in kindergarten. So this is, here's the bird's head, here's the feathers. And this is a Berber good luck symbol, having a bird shape. There's certain birds up in the Atlas Mountains that are considered good luck. And so what you've got here is a Berber good luck charm combined with the Star of David, combined with the hand of Fatima. And of course, for the people who are using this, they're not thinking, oh, I'm combining three religions. They're thinking, this is a Jewish symbol. It goes to say how there is this religious synthesis going on in Morocco, in this so-called Jewish, good luck charm. Let's see, I think I got some pictures. All right, I started to show you this map, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria. On this trip that I took, we actually moved around. We were in Rabat, the capital city, for a while. Then we were in Fez, this kind of old medieval city. Spent some time up in the High Atlas, to Marrakesh, to Casablanca. And then we were also in Tunisia. We were in Tunis, Kairouan, Sfax, and off the shore in Djerba. Kind of moved around a little bit. But you get the idea here. But I guess for our purposes, the Jewish populations in the Maghreb have mostly been in either in these kind of trade ports on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, or in these kind of more scholarly capitals like Fez or commercial centers, or in the trade towns, actually, what they call the anti-Atlas, or behind the Atlas Mountains, along the north shore, as it were, of the Sahara Desert, were also during medieval times large Jewish populations. And so there's a long, long history of Judaism in the Maghreb. I'll come back to Arab expansion in a second. Just to make my point, just going back to some of the ancient history of Judaism in the Western Mediterranean, as explained to us in Morocco and Tunisia, there's some evidence that those Jewish populations already going back to ancient Phoenicians, the Punics, before the Romans, that was this kind of part of the Phoenician diaspora, as it were, from the Western Mediterranean, from the area of what's today Palestine, included Jews, who are also part of that diaspora as merchants way back, 700 BC. And so then they settled in North Africa as well as in Spain and so forth way back whenever. The other thing to keep in mind, and this then continued during the Roman era and during the Greek era, going back to ancient times has always been a steady population of Jewish merchants in various parts of the Western Mediterranean. Phrase I didn't write up here is Sephardic Judaism versus Ashkenazi Judaism. And my apologies to the religious studies professors. I'm just going to say two words about that. I think when most people think of Judaism, they think of Ashkenazi Judaism, or the Judaism that developed in Northern Europe and Eastern Europe. That we associate with Yiddish, that we associate with, deli foods or matzo ball soup or. There's so many things about Judaism in the United States that is really specifically Ashkenazi Judaism from Europe, from Western and Eastern Europe. From what you have at the same time is Sephardic Judaism, which develops, most people think of Spain, but other definitions would say, no, it's basically anything around the Mediterranean. That includes Morocco and Tunisia and the Maghreb. And for them, you could say their version of Yiddish, rather than sort of being German-Hebrew mix, is Spanish, Judeo-Spanish, so if you will, the Sephardic equivalent of Yiddish, as well as all the other cultural influences. So it's a very different Judaism than what you find in Europe, because it's, as with Judaism in Europe, how it's influenced by the European culture, Judaism in Spain and the Maghreb similarly sort of adopts the foods, clothing, music styles of the culture, the society in which it's embedded. And so that's what happens here as well. So I'm just kind of mentioning that to illustrate that this phenomenon happens elsewhere as well. So then what happens, right? So you have this ancient population of Jews living in the area, then you have Arab expansion takes place, the conquest by Arab armies, soon encompasses the Maghreb, is included into this empire, by 750. And then what develops? Well, as most of you are familiar with, what happens to Jews under Muslim government? Well, this is another, actually going back to this map here, it's kind of a misunderstanding. I mean, when this Arab expansion takes place, the objective is not to convert people to Islam. I mean, as much as people say they come in with swords, trying to converting people at the point of the sword, what it was is it was about spreading Islamic government. They had no intentions of spreading Islam, but rather of spreading Islamic government. For the first 700 years under Arab rule, Egypt remains predominantly Christian. About 300 years, the Coptic Christians remain a majority in Egypt. So similar things happen further west. But there isn't this widespread expectation by the Arab generals that the local populations convert to Islam. They're happy to content to let them remain non-Muslim as long as they pay their taxes and obey the Islamic laws. So the same thing happens with Jews. I mean, Jews and Christians are given the special status of people of the book, or dhimmi. They have to pay a slightly higher tax, but they're allowed to continue to worship and whatever they want, to keep their money, to still run their shops. I mean, there's this kind of wisdom in the part of the Arab conquerors. They don't want to lose the tax base. They don't want to disgruntle these well-established commercial networks. They'd rather just kind of slide in as the ruling class and let the economy continue as it is. And so that continues for a long time. Like I said, already, Christianity continues as the majority religion in much of the of North Africa for a good 200, 300 years. And Judaism, similar. Jewish populations remain Jewish, and there's little pressure for them to convert. And then what happens in the western part here, as you can see, is the Umayyad Caliphate. Or on this side is really what we think of as Spain and Morocco, and the Maghreb really develop as a single culture. Again, I think this goes to sort of modern prejudices or assumptions. We see this clean break between, the Mediterranean between Africa and Europe. But the reality is for centuries, Spain and Morocco were one culture. There was, that this wasn't, the Straits of Gibraltar were not seen as a divide, but as a connection between the two. Spain was ruled by Moroccans for many years, and the cultural influences went back and forth both directions. As an illustration of this, I'll show you this. Pictures of minarets. I mean, the Almohads dynasty, when it ruled both Morocco and Spain, built these distinctive towers, minarets, prayer towers for their mosques. Well, yeah, Marrakesh was the first of them, Rabat was the second of them. The third one was in Seville, which you might not recognize it now because they built a cathedral around it. They knocked down the mosque and said, wait a second, that minaret, that looks like a fine steeple. Let's convert it into a steeple. So now it's got bells hanging in it. They don't do the call to prayer anymore. But it was built by the Almohads before later it was converted into a cathedral. And you find this throughout Spain. I mean, whether it's the Alhambra, all these old palaces and the language and so forth, Spain was under Muslim rule for longer, you could say, than under Christian rule. So to say that, what does it mean for a country to be Christian or Muslim? There are elements of this sort of single culture, if you will, in the Western Mediterranean, olive groves. This is an olive grove in Tunisia. Roman Empire, I mean, some of the finest Roman mosaics you can find in Tunisia, not in Italy or Europe. This is the third largest Colosseum. And you'll find it in Tunisia at El Jem. People in Tunisia today, talking with people there, they point out to me that culturally and geographically, they're closer to Italy than they are to Saudi Arabia. Even though I think we tend to think of them as part of the so-called Muslim world or Arab world, their own history, their own culture, their own way of looking at the world, the layers of Greek, Roman influence is just as strong and is just as integral to their culture in Tunisia as it is to Italy or to France or Greece and so forth. And so I think, again, it's trying to illustrate what I learned about North Africa really belongs to this Mediterranean world. And Arabs point out that as well. We think of Alexander the Great as being European, but his entire career was spent in what today are Muslim areas. That Hellenistic culture, Greek culture, belongs to the Arabs as much, if not more, than it does to Europeans. Just look at the geography of it. Plato, Arabs knew about Plato before Europeans did. Before Northern Europeans did. Cosmopolitan towns is another part of this, where you just have a sort of mixture of different cultures. There's a painting that illustrates that, from 1875, a French painter, marriage, a Jewish wedding in Tangier. It shows you the dancing, shows you the clothing style, shows you the music. Cover the word for Jewish there, you might think, well, that's just an Arab wedding, or that's a Muslim wedding or something. But it's a Jewish family celebrating. There are some subtle distinctions there, the colors, the patterns that would distinguish them as Jewish in Maghreb culture. But I think someone who's, if you're not, like myself, not as familiar with it, you might say, oh, that's just an Arab wedding or whatever that would be. As I've got in the back of this hand, it changes over time, how much kind of the Jewish population is. But Fez, for example, by the 1400s, 1500s, is about 10% Jewish. And there's other towns in the Maghreb, and especially particularly Morocco, that have reached similar high concentrations of Jews. These cosmopolitan towns, particularly Fez, attract not just Jewish merchants, but also Jewish scholars. This is a picture of Fez in Morocco, where I visited. And this is the Medina, which is basically just the Arabic word for town, and now it comes to mean sort of the old quarter of the town. There's a view from outside looking down. It's actually the largest medieval, sort of preserved medieval quarter, at least the tour guides here say that, in the world. It's in terms of its warren of lanes and shops and no motorized traffic can fit in here. You only see about half of it here. It kind of spreads off, sprawls that way as well. So it's just, if you want to get lost, it's really easy to just kind of wander and explore through all the shops and stuff. But over here, I'll show you a close-up, is sort of the area where the Cairoian University is. Venerable old university. Of course, they claim to be the oldest university. Oxford says, no, we are. Everyone wants to be the oldest university. But here's a close-up. Which is the El Rasif Mosque, and then the university sort of grounds over there with the green tile roof. But what this is significant for is the scholars. That as Jews were sort of, did get forced out of Spain, particularly after 1492 when Ferdinand and Isabella declared that Jews were no longer allowed in Spain, thousands of them fled and followed some of their predecessors to Morocco. And so many of them, even before that, though, we spent a lot of time in Morocco, who were born in Spain, moved to Fez. And so Fez became a very important scholastic center, academic center. So you had anyone who was anyone living in the Western Mediterranean, if they wanted to learn about Plato, Aristotle, or they wanted to learn about science and mathematics, because it would come to the University of Fez. Because again, it's the Arabs, obviously you give us our number system. I don't know anyone who writes out their checks using Roman numerals. So the whole algebra, alchemy, all these sort of this basis of science and math, everything was modern, were invented by these Arab scholars working in these universities here, as well as in Cairo and in other parts of the Muslim world. So among the more famous Jewish scholars who were resident here for a while, Moses Maimonides, or in Hebrew, Moshe ben Maimon, or in Arabic, Musa ibn Mahmoud. And I just put a few quotes from him on the handout, which we can read over in a little bit. One aspect of this, though, is the melas, these Jewish quarters that developed. Now you get to look at how much integration is taking place if you have these separate neighborhoods for Jewish residents. Some of this, most of this happens after about 1500, 1600, as the population grows. There are some rulers of Fez, of the dynasty there, who feel that the Jews should be contained. Now that becomes an open question then, to what extent was it the decision of the government, to what extent was it the decision of the Jews to retain and preserve their culture? In any case, you do have this different, separate neighborhood, then develops like between 1600 and 1800, it becomes then a phenomenon. Every major town in Morocco and in Tunisia develops kind of a Jewish quarter, where it's primarily merchants, who are well connected with Jewish merchants across the Sahara Desert and elsewhere in the world, sort of set up shop. And one thing distinctive about it, which I think is interesting, that shows you're in the Mela, is the presence of balconies. Because in a strict Muslim household, the women and children are expected to be inside the home and not visible to the general public. And so what you have in a typical Muslim home is you have a big spacious courtyard on the inside, that sort of domestic space that where the women and children hang out around a cool courtyard. Whereas in the Jewish household, you also have a balcony on the outside, so the women and children can kind of see what's going on in the outside world. Because, yeah, so balconies are a distinctive characteristic of Jewish homes in the Mela. Other pictures from Fez. They still have synagogues in every major Moroccan town. And this, they showed us the Torah in the Fez, one of the Fez synagogues, the Jewish cemetery in Fez. Where the family of Maimonides buried his relatives. He himself, I think he ended up in Israel. But he was originally from Spain, and he studied in Fez for a while, then he taught in Cairo, and then ended up elsewhere. I already kind of talked about this other stuff. So a synthesis of different traditions. This is what I think is interesting. There's another synagogue in Tunisia on the island of Djerba. But you can see how the Jewish architecture incorporates, if you will, Muslim or Middle Eastern styles in the architecture as well as in the mosaics. Mosaics are sort of indistinguishable from the kind of mosaics you'd find in a mosque in the Maghreb. And these are a group of men studying there. Moroccan Passover. It stole this picture from the internet, but shows you a very distinctive Moroccan style of decorating pottery, and here they're using it for the Passover plate and cup, made in a Moroccan style. And then the amulet I already talked about, Jewish rubber Handa Fatima pendant. There's another example of this kind of synthesis of traditions. I want to show you a little video. My apologies, my computer is too slow to fully capture it. So the sound is going to be good, but the picture is going to be kind of herky-jerky, so my apologies for that. This is a fairly acclaimed performer, scholar of Sephardic Jewish music, Vanessa Paloma. If you go to YouTube and say Vanessa Paloma, you'll get scores of hits. I encourage you to look at more of her music. And she gave a sort of a personal performance just for our seminar group. But what she does is she's found the old notations for these songs, and some of them passed down through the generations, and then performs them. Some of them are wedding songs, some of them are ballads, there's a whole different range of kinds of music out of this tradition. But what I found most interesting about it, for the purposes of this, was how they, again, were a synthesis. So what she's going to sing here is a song actually from the liturgy of a Jewish worship service in Morocco, from Fez, from like 17th century Fez. But she's going to sing it, and it incorporates three different languages. Judeo-Spanish, which is sort of this Hebrew-influenced medieval Spanish, as well as Darija, the sort of Moroccan dialect of Arabic, as well as Hebrew, kind of liturgical Hebrew. So it's sort of at the end of the of a Jewish worship service. Thank you. the last thing I'll say is, well, so what happens to this convivencia, this living together during the 20th century? Well, I mean, the population of Jews in Morocco in 1950 is about 250,000. Today it's less than 6,000. So what happens there? Well, I guess a couple of things happen there. One is the Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria all win their independence from French colonial rule. During the French colonial period, the Jewish population tended to side more with the French colonizers than with the Arab majority. Because one, because they were, many of them are merchants, and so it's kind of a natural fit. I mean, as the French colonial government is trying to set up shop and control the economy, they naturally turned to the Jewish population because they couldn't control the economy without their assistance. So that's part of it, and there's a sense on the part of the Jews that, okay, well, we can, you know, I don't know if you want to call it collaboration, it's probably too, isn't the right word to use, but the sense that in order to benefit from the colonial presence, they start to attend schools, learn French, and adopt European culture, and sort of move away from Arab influence. Well, at the same time, especially near the end of the colonial period, is the creation of the State of Israel, 1948, well, 47, 48. And so this then results in a mass exodus of Jews from Morocco to Israel, and actually some of them go elsewhere. Many of them stay initially, but then once the independent country of Morocco sides with Egypt and other Arab countries against Israel, then there's this very real sense of hostility, the sense that they're no longer welcome in Morocco. But that hadn't always existed. I mean, in Morocco today, I mean, people said it again and again, they would tell the story, and some argue that was it true or not. I mean, when World War II started, and Morocco was sort of under the control of Vichy France, you know, and so sort of indirectly by Nazi Germany, Germans came to round up Jews, and the king of Morocco refused to turn them over. He said, there are no Jews here, there's only Moroccans here. Or he said, I'm a Jew as well, you can't take me. Whatever it was, I mean, there's different versions of the story, and some say it's maybe not have been true. But the fact is that, you know, the Holocaust did not reach as far as Morocco. So there's this switch. So, you know, I mean, basically with the kind of the rise of Arab nationalism during the 1950s, and ultimately in the competition with Israel, and so this puts the Jews in Morocco in a very uncomfortable position, where they have to choose between being Moroccan or Jewish, in a sense, because to be Moroccan then by the 1960s explicitly tied then with Arab countries in unity against Israel. And so that's what happened. So you still have synagogues and museums in Morocco and Tunisia today, and very small Jewish populations who are told that they're welcome, and there's no record of sort of open hostility against Jews, but there is this sense that they can only go so far in business and in government in Morocco and Tunisia today, and that they have more opportunities in Israel and the United States and elsewhere. Right, and so that's kind of what I had to say. And maybe I could just start with a general question. I just find this fascinating. I guess I find the Maghreb fascinating, and I find it, you know, sort of, it challenges assumptions about ethnic and religious diversity in my mind, and I guess I'd be curious to start off. Do you agree, or maybe you have questions? Yeah.
How do they all share the same scriptures that overlap? How do they view some of their shared scriptures?
Like,
if you were going to school, would you be exposed to religious education in a school setting? If you were, would it be Jewish or Christian or Arab, Islamic?
Oh, I mean, in Morocco. If a Jewish child wants to learn about the Torah in Morocco, they'd have to go to the Jewish school. It wouldn't be public. It wouldn't be offered in the public school. But that's a good question. You know, what the public school curriculum in Morocco, how it treats Judaism. I suspect it's in line with sort of Orthodox Islam, that they're seen as people of the book and respected for this kind of shared monotheistic tradition. But it's going to be in Arabic, not Hebrew.
What's the awareness of that? Do they even understand that they have that shared tradition from the book itself? I mean, is there discussion about that or recognition?
Well, in the Quran, it's explicit over and over again. Yeah, that they share the same tradition. I mean,
but as their life as groups together, do they say, well, we have this in common? I mean, is that a topic of awareness or? practiced, I guess, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think it's more divided. I mean, the civic...
Even though it's shared, they don't pay that much.
Right, I didn't see any evidence of sort of, you know, group picnics between synagogues and mosques. You know. That was, culturally, or socially distinct, I would say.
Okay.
But then drawn together, in terms of economics. But that's the thing, it's tough to, I mean, most of what I've described in terms of this cooperation is more historical. I mean, so in that way, it's sort of hard to get at. You get at it through the stories and the clear evidence in the neighborhoods and in the descriptions from the pre-1900. But the 20th century, I think people tend to look at the past and through the lens of the 20th century and just assume that there's always been this antagonism, when the history shows that it's not inevitable.
Do you see this as a whole lot different from what exists in major U.S. cities? For example, there is tolerance. And it sounds like there's a lot of tolerance here. And what would you see as the distinctive difference there as compared to here?
Or are you saying there's tolerance in both cities?
Well,
or,
no, I'm saying that there seems to be tolerance in North Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's not conflict. There seems to be some collaboration and respect and some acceptance of each other's religion.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be true, does it not, to a certain degree, in a lot of places? Or
around
the
world?
Not in the Middle East, but here in the United States.
Well, I would say, I think there's more tolerance than there is fighting. I mean, maybe I'm being a little idealistic here. Ask me to kind of talk about the world as a whole?
No. I'm saying that I don't see it as particularly unique, other than what our impressions might be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've kind of set that straight in terms of our impressions, because we might have an impression that it was going to be a lot of conflict, and yet there seems to be quite a degree of tolerance.
Well, I guess, yeah, that would be maybe the question I would pose to everybody. I mean, what might explain it? When do sort of different religious groups... What are the factors that influence whether religious groups get along with each other or don't get along with each other?
Yeah.
And that might help us to try and detect patterns here.
Yeah.
What about the Berbers? You kind of glossed over them.
Right. Well, that's true. I mean, some people actually have attributed some of Morocco's sort of relative tranquility to the Berber influence, and this is really becoming a big part of it now. In Morocco, it's funny now that during the French colonization, before that, everyone wanted to be Arab. You know, when it was under sort of quote unquote Arab rule, even though it was really Berber rule. But today in Morocco, everyone's sort of proud, suddenly proud of Berber heritage. Everyone said, "Yeah, I'm 1/8 Berber. I'm 1/4 Berber." And so they're really embracing this heritage. And I think one reason for that is it sets them apart from Saudi Arabia, from the Arab world. They can say, "Well, we're not, don't associate us with those Wahhabis, with the Islamists over there. We're, first and foremost Berber." And that's sort of the foundation for our culture and society. And so then in terms of this Islamic or, Christian and Muslim synthesis, whether the Berbers were particularly adept at that, I'm not sure, but they certainly have had all three of those religions. I mean, I'll talk more about that later in the week, sort of North Moroccan, Tunisian-style Christianity. And then, St. Augustine was a Berber himself. I mean, his mother tongue wasn't Latin, it was a Berber language. To be honest, I'm not sure if that played a role in terms of distinguishing themselves. I think it probably did, distinguishing themselves both from Rome, certainly, so they didn't kind of fall into that, and from the Ottomans. Morocco was never under Ottoman Turkish rule. And in terms of distinguishing themselves from sort of the Arab heartland, very quickly the local Muslim rulers were Berbers rather than Arab.
Those Berbers strictly, do they have borders?
It's a kind of a general ethnic term to describe these closely related groups that flow over between Morocco, Mauritania. I mean, it's across the Sahara Desert,
right,
to a certain extent as well, into Algeria, Tunisia. No, there's no Berber country.
No, I know that, but I just was wondering how far the range went.
Yeah, no, they went, I guess going back to the map, I mean, most of the sort of northwest corner, if you will, of Africa, I would say, is dominated by Berber groups into Mali and into sub-Saharan Africa as well. The Tuareg are arguably a Berber group. Anna.
No, this is fascination. It's fascinating for me in a different reason than all of you here, because my husband isn't here with me, but he was born in Tunisia, and his name is Judah, but it was Jean-Claude. And a fourth of him is Jewish, and part of him was Catholic, and I don't know as much about this at all, Lutheran, but just to say that this is very interesting for me to hear more about these
things. Very clear evidence of, you know, of this phenomenon, right? Yeah, Tunisia, I've been talking most about Morocco, but Tunisia is another whole case, and I mean, it's also in the Maghreb, but they even orient themselves more to Italy and Europe. I think they see themselves. They and Phoenician, they're, you know, on their money, they have these, you know, the Carthaginian queen and so forth. So they, it's interesting what they embrace in their history. Yeah.
Is Ethiopia in the Maghreb then?
No, that's, yeah,
I can flip back to that map.
Well, yeah, this doesn't show you where Ethiopia is. No, Ethiopia is at the other side of Africa.
Let's see, do I have another map? Well, I guess my Arab conquest map would include some of that.
No? Sorry, I don't have I don't have a wall there, but if you wanted to see it, I could show you. But no, Ethiopia is a whole different thing. But yeah, the Berbers going, you know, encompass. There's kind of Berber groups all through here. And that's the main language spoken in the Sahara Desert. Yeah.
The Berber is originally like a nomadic tribe? Or?
Well, not really. I mean, it's. I would say, well, Berber, they don't call themselves Berber. Berber is the same root as barbarian. That's what the Greeks called them, was people who were barbarians. They don't speak Greek, therefore they're Berber. They're just saying bar, 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 you know, they're Berber. No, they call themselves Amazigh. Amazigh. But there's different, what do they speak again? I can't remember the name of the language. But that's just the name they've adopted now. But there's actually different other groups. I mean, they're nomadic primarily, but there's farming communities all throughout the Atlas Mountains. But they're also predominantly herders. But there's different language, you know, sort of dialects that or different language, Berber languages that are, you know, but some of them are organized tribally, some of them are not.
Sounds like the whole area, though, is very diverse as far as cultures, though, too.
Well, that's my impression. I mean, especially if you get, you know, if you include all three of these countries, because Algeria then had about 1 million French people speaking, living there at one point, you know, during the 19th, 20th century. But Tunisia in particular, I mean, because that was part of, you know, the Carthaginian Empire, and then the Roman Empire, and, you know, Greek, you know, influence, and it's just like all these layers of history. And then, yeah, I didn't even talk about it. Like Malta. I don't know if anyone else is familiar with Malta. Another phenomenon. Malta was, you know, under, as was Sicily, was under Muslim rule for a long time. And so Malta today, they're like, Maltese is Arabic. It's a form of Arabic. But they're Christian. So it's Arabic-speaking Christians. It's the Maltese culture. Yeah, any other comments or questions or thoughts about this?
Interested in modernity, but it is you said a lot of herders and rural agricultural based, is that undergoing a significant change now, or is that still?
Yeah, as most places, I mean, a lot of people moving into the cities hoping to find jobs and
better.
The cities are really growing quickly in the Maghreb. Tunis and Rabat and Casablanca are all kind of booming in industrial cities.
Tunisia had that big revolt.
Is
it safe there now? What's going on?
Yeah, well,
I
had to drop one of my five sessions, and I'm afraid I dropped the Tunisian Revolution one. But we were there just a few months after it happened. In fact, we were there when they were going to hold the first elections. They decided to postpone it because they felt they weren't quite ready to have elections without problems. Well, yeah, I can give you a little 2-minute synopsis of that session. Basically, I mean, what Tunisia is wrestling with, as Egypt is in other places, is they had this whole Arab Spring, this, you know, democratic revolution, overthrew their dictators, and now they're hoping for more rights. But the question is, okay, what kind of government are they going to vote into power? And what has happened in Tunisia, as in other places, but not quite as strong in Tunisia, is that the Islamist parties have the most sort of respect and trust from the people. They feel like they're the least likely to fall into this pattern of corruption that they've sort of, you know, seen, you know, as they're regarded as as you know, that they're going to pass laws that are more for the good of the general public, that they're going to be guided by Islamic principles, religious principles, to not just be selfish dictators. And so there's kind of this hope that the more sort of they espouse Islamic principles, then the more democratic the government is going to be, if you will, the more government will serve people's interests. But now in Tunisia, that's a problem because it really has, of all these three Maghrebi countries, has the strongest sort of secularist tradition, the sense that you should separate church and politics. And so now there is this tension in Tunisia over that. I mean, the Ennahda, the Islamic party that won the elections in October, actually they postponed them to October, they won enough to, they now control the constituent assembly. They're now in the process of writing a new constitution. And the Ennahda party got 40% of the vote, so it's not a super majority, but all the other parties got less than 40%. So the Islamist party, Ennahda, is sort of in the, but they can't operate without making a coalition with some secularist parties. So it still remains to be seen what the constitution is going to look like. How much influence will the Islamist party have on it? How much, I mean, I've promised already, you know, they're not going to try and introduce some Saudi Arabian kind of real strict Islamic government. You know, that women, you know, are not going to be required to wear veils, and you know, and women can drive cars and so forth. So they're, so it's going to be a Western, they're trying to create from scratch this kind of Western-style Islamic government.
So it wouldn't be maybe like the purge they're putting on in Egypt as far as the Coptic Christians and things like that?
Yeah, well, there was some tensions in Tunisia about that, but it was immediately put down. I mean, there was, I visited one Catholic church in Tunisia where there had been a firebomb, and somebody threw a Molotov cocktail against the door, and but then other young people immediately rallied around it, put out the fire, and then spray painted on the wall, well, across from the church. What was it? Again, something like, I can't remember what it was in French. It was basically something like, you know, we are fellow Tunisians. Don't pay attention to these crazy guys. The essence of what it is. So you have that tension. So you have some young people who are sort of, you know, firebrand, you know, ideologically, you know, going for this Islamism, but they're a small minority, I would say, in Tunisia still. But it still, it remains to be seen, because you can have a small minority that, you know, has all, you know, takes all power, seizes power too. So it's, you know, and that's what in Egypt they're worried about now, because the most of the people didn't want to have the situation where they have to choose now between, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with what's happening in Egypt, and they're kind of stuck between this kind of Islamist candidate and the secularist candidate, and they say, well, we want something kind of in between. Yeah.
Is our government just watching, or are we trying to ally or promote?
Well, that's the thing, you know. As elsewhere, I think we don't want to support anyone too strongly, or it might undermine their position, because and they can be seen as stooges of the United States. But clearly, the United States would, you know, I think we're not necessarily opposed to Ennahda, like in Tunisia, having that kind of power. But as long as they remain secularist. And there's a hope that Tunisia will kind of emulate what's happening in Turkey, because Turkey is run by an Islamist party, but secularism is such an ingrained part of their society that, I mean, there's limits to what they can do. But that's the contrast in Morocco. Morocco hasn't had any, the Arab Spring, you know, went by Morocco. There was a few protests and stuff, but it's still a monarchy. There's nothing democratic about it. So you'd think they have the best grounds for it. So what's happened there, and I'll talk about this later in the week, is how the Moroccan king has sort of embraced Sufi Islam as well as Berber identity as a way to unite the people. He's like saying, you don't want to overthrow me. We're all Berbers. We're all Sufi Muslims. So trying to kind of generate this Moroccan national identity that would supersede any kind of Islamism. Islamist influence coming from Saudi Arabia.
What about that big chunk in the middle called Algeria?
Right. Well, that's another. We'll see a movie about that tomorrow.
Okay.
But yeah, that there, yeah, different thing happened there. When they basically, the Islamists won the election in '92, '93, '94. In the early '90s, they won the election, but the government said, we didn't want you to win, so we, you know, invalidate the election because we don't want Islamists in charge.
What if they could do that here?
Invalidate the election. Have the military say, we don't like who you chose. Right.
It's interesting to me, in light of religious cooperation, that secularism gets held up as sort of the model in this day and age. So Turkey, you know, it goes better in Turkey because they're secular. And I mean, I think I see some inclinations of that in our own country, that religion is uncomfortable, and so better to just leave it alone and...
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. I don't know if anyone, you know, is religion sort of inherently intolerant? Is secularism tolerant and religion intolerant? Can one have a tolerant and pluralistic religious government? No, I don't know. I don't know. I'm curious. Because that's what, I guess, I, you know, getting back to the beginning of my lecture, that's, I think, what Maghreb has sort of wrestled with, is when it had this Islamic government for much of its history, I would argue it was still pluralistic and, you know.
What about the Scandinavian countries? I mean, officially, the Lutheran Church is their church.
Oh, right.
I'm not sure if that's accurate or not.
Yeah, I guess they have still a monarchs, too.
They changed it to secular, like a week ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So the churches are without any tax money anymore?
I don't know the full specifics. I think that.
Yeah, I think that happened in Germany, too, and they recently disallowed. All right, well, thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.